Hello, and welcome to Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to break the taboos around death and dying and learn to talk about it. Thank you if you've been listening since the beginning, and if you have, you'll know we've covered so many aspects of death and dying, from what it's actually like to die, to how it feels to lose your nearest and dearest, the different ways grief can strike, the different ways we cope or don't with loss, how counselling can help, what part faith can play, how to help others going through grief, and how to pick up the pieces and rebuild a life after a big loss. This afternoon, I'm really pleased to be joined by Rabbi Jonathan Romaine, who would like to talk and put his opinion forward on assisted dying. And I will be talking to somebody else who has a different opinion on assisted dying later, which we'll use as well as this. So Jonathan, do you want to begin by explaining why you're so pro?
Well, I wasn't always. I think initially I was against, I suppose for all the knee-jerk reasons that people are, without having desperately gone into it. But what happened is, as a congregational minister, I went to a lot of hospitals and hospices and became increasingly worried by the number of people who were dying badly. Not because of the nurses who gave wonderful care at both hospitals and hospices, but because they had conditions where they just could not be helped. And then the turning point, I remember this very vividly, was I went to see one person, I'll call him Colin, who was not in his bed, he was literally on his bed, on his knees, and with his head in between his knees, because that was the only way he could control the pain. And I thought, there has to be a better way than this. So I began looking into it, and then found that the safeguards that were being proposed, in other words, you had to be terminally ill, not like in your mid-40s and depressed, but terminally ill, you were dying already, and you had to be of sound mind, so not someone like Alzheimer's, or where you weren't really sure what they wanted, and you had to it had to be clearly of your own free will. In other words, you'd given statements to the doctors without anybody else present that this is what you wanted. Given those three conditions, then those were the very tight regulations that were being proposed. So terminally ill, sound mind, and free will. And it seemed to me this was pretty strong stuff, and it was pretty safe. And then the third thing that really helped me was I realised that we weren't sort of like a venture into the dark. This had actually been going on in Oregon, in the States, for 25 years. 25 years! That's a quarter of a century of research and medical expertise. And like, you know, so, it worked well. In fact, it worked well with palliative care. And whereas palliative care, people had been against the introduction of assisted dying, now that it was there, they worked very well in harmony with it. And I thought, my goodness me, you know, we have got such a lot of track record. This is a pretty safe place to go. And so ever since then, I've been campaigning in favour of it. In fact, I'm now chair of Dignity in Dying nationally. And as you probably know, there's been an enormous tipping point recently. I mean, people have been in favour of it for 20, 30, 40 years. But there's been a growing public awareness that it's needed. And then we've had some very high-profile people like Prue Leith or Esther Ranson, and now the message has got through to the politicians, and so both Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer have promised that in the next Parliament they will allow time for a conscience vote, as it should be. So I'm pretty sure that it'll probably come about fairly soon, and only because it's needed, and only as an option for those who so wish. I mean, most of us, to be honest, we'll probably carry on to our dying breath because we've got that really, really strong life force. But it's really helpful to know that if things do get pear-shaped, and there's so many awful diseases, as you know only too well, cancer, motor neuron, Parkinson's, and that if things can go horribly wrong, then people don't have to spend their last few weeks or months in agony. And to me, that's not just a humanitarian response, it's a religious response, because there's nothing sacred about suffering, nothing holy about agony. And if people want to say, thank you, God, it's been a great life, but now's time to gently hand it back and let go, then why not? I mean, what do we achieve by forcing them to live on in pain? In fact, I put it even more strongly than that and say it's actually rather arrogant of one person to say to another person, because of my beliefs, my theology, thou shalt suffer on.
What about the view that people have about the sanctity of life?
Oh, I agree with it entirely. Life is special. It should be taken seriously. It should be lived to the full and in harmony with that of other people. But it doesn't have to be a sort of an ideology that means when life is no longer worth living in the eyes of that particular person, that they have to carry on with it if they do not wish to do so.
I've often thought that the move that we are experiencing at the moment towards being more people being in favour of assisted dying may well be because the baby boomers are driving it, because this is a generation that's been so used to having the best of everything, really getting what they want throughout their lives, and suddenly they find themselves here towards the end of life thinking, well, I can't have my own way in this.
Well, there's a grain of truth in the fact that it's to do also with autonomy and free will. I mean, if you think about it, most of us, if we're lucky enough, get to choose what we do in life, where we live, who we marry, what career we pursue, where we go on holiday. Why should we not be able to choose the manner of death? Perhaps one of the most important aspects of it, and particularly if it is agonising and painful. And there's, you know, unless you have a, to me, a fairly warped view of pain and suffering being of value, I do not see why we shouldn't try and avoid it. So I welcome this change.
Have you come across anyone who's had to go to Zurich?
I haven't in my own personal circle, but I certainly know of dozens and dozens of people. And the problem is that although it's certainly an option, it's not a great option. And in fact, really, the situation for those people who are suffering, they've got all bad options. I mean, either they just suffer on at the moment and there's nothing they can do about it, or, sadly, they attempt suicide, and if it's botched, they end up worse than they were in the beginning, and if it's successful, then, okay, they've gone, but it's pretty horrible for the relatives to pick up the pieces, literally. Or thirdly, they can go to Zurich, Dignitas, but that means, A, it's expensive, so it's only open to the more wealthy, and how fair is that? And also it means you have to go much earlier than you would do, because you have to be fit enough to travel abroad on a plane, and therefore you're letting go of life before you might otherwise want to. The other thing, by the way, about why there I think the public view has changed is because of medical advances, which means that we are living longer, but not necessarily better. And I think there was some statistic that came out the other day that we're on average living an extra 2 years, but only sort of 0.4 of those extra 2 years are good years. And there's a lot of pain. And if we can endure it, or people want to carry on to the last minute, great, let's give them every help, palliative care, hospital, whatever. But if they want to let go, whose life is it?
There's probably something also, isn't there, about, I mean, I'll come back to the baby boomers, but people, I suppose, of my generation who have been used to getting our own way, like you said, in so many things, don't want to lose our dignity at the very end. We might be prepared to suffer, but we don't particularly want to hand over our care to strangers, people we don't know.
Yes, I'm sure that's true. And I think the two main reasons people opt for assisted dying is either just the excruciating pain, and that's not to be underestimated, or the what you might call the loss of dignity. But it isn't just sort of like a vanity thing. It means you actually lose control, and you cannot, not only you can't lift things and you can't walk, but you have to be spoon-fed and you have to be washed by somebody else, and life loses not just its dignity but its meaning.
But what do you say to people? I mean, I understand, I gather that a lot of people who are disabled are really worried about this coming in, aren't they? Because they feel they'll be somehow encouraged to end their lives earlier than they would have done.
Oh, that's an absolute false alarm. Just because you are disabled doesn't mean to say you have a terminal illness. And, you know, if you're disabled, yes, of course, you have limitations, but you might well live a very creative and enriching life and for another 20, 30, 40, 50 years. This is why I'm so confident about the restrictions. It's limited to someone who is terminally ill. And it doesn't matter whether they're able-bodied or disabled, only if they are terminally ill. So disabled people, they're not in a special category.
But the other argument you hear all the time is from people saying, anybody who is, it's got to be terminally ill, as you say, might be persuaded to hurry along the process by relatives who are greedy and trying to get their inheritances.
Yes, there's this sort of image of the sort of little old lady with the loot under the bed and the horrible sounds. Well, all I can tell you is that in Oregon, and I come back to Oregon, I mean, there are many, many places throughout on the English-speaking world and Europe where they also have assisted dying. But Oregon, they've done it for 25 years. And what they've found is two interesting things. Firstly, it's largely the more affluent and successful who go in for it, you know, the AB class, as opposed to people, in other words, people used to making decisions, used to being proactive, and used to being in control. And the other thing is that tens of thousands of people apply for it, but only a few go for it and activate it. I think it's something like 1.1% of all deaths in Oregon are actually assisted suicide. In other words, a lot of people get the piece of paper that says you may now proceed if you so wish, because they want to almost have it as a sort of emotional safety net, so they know that if things go horrible, then there is this way out. But actually, the life force in us means that we continue on.
I heard yesterday, I think it was in one of the Sunday papers, the story of a 33-year-old woman in the Netherlands who has chosen to end her life. She's not terminally ill, but she is very depressed. Oh, are you telling me that that wouldn't be possible under our rules?
Yes, I am telling you that, because they have different rules. And they have a position which is much, much broader than in this country, and they don't have the terminally ill clause, which is why I quote Oregon, because they do have that terminally ill clause. Now, and I'm pretty sure that that would not get passed in this country, and all the high polling, and we're talking about recently came out at 75% in favour of assisted dying, was given that it was terminally ill, not as a blanket thing if you're depressed in your 30s, as we all know, you can have a bad patch and then recover and be very glad you recovered.
What if it's just old age and somebody is fed up with being infirm, say when they're in there and they reach their 90s and they think they've had a jolly good life? That's not going to be covered.
No, I mean, if you're talking about legislation, it has to be pretty sort of red line where if there is, it goes to a judicial assessment or a medical assessment, the doctors have to know this is the cliff edge and you're either up to it or you've gone past it. And that's why, you know, we're so adamant, we, Dignity in Dying, is so adamant about those three things, worth repeating: terminally ill, of your own free will, and mentally competent.
I don't want to be nitpicking here, but if you're very old, and if you really are of a great age, you're going to die anyway, aren't you? So you couldn't I argue that I'm terminally ill because I'm 99 or something?
Not at all. I made the dreadful mistake of Nicholas Winton, who used to live up the road. I was thinking of asking him to give a lecture, and I thought, no, he's a bit too old for this. And he was 95. You know, blow me, he carries on from 100 to 104. thou shalt not judge. You have to be terminally ill, by which I mean not old, but doctors have said you have a condition which means you are going to die, I'm afraid, within the next 6 months.
And what about the people who say, and I've met a number of them during the course of these interviews, who say if palliative care were better or more widely available, then this new law would not be needed?
It's certainly a good thing to have palliative care and to have it much better funded at the moment, because at the moment it's what you call a lottery, sort of a postal lottery. It's good in some areas and not available in others. And palliative care is wonderful. I can't do anything but sing the praises of hospices, but it can't cure everybody. In fact, this came out, as you may know, there was a parliamentary select committee which delivered a paper last month. So we're talking about February or March 2024, after 18 months of delivery, in which they had expert witnesses from palliative care who said, yes, we can do a lot to help people, but there are conditions we cannot help. It was actually quite interesting. It was the first time the palliative care experts had admitted that there are limits, something that, frankly, we all knew anecdotally, but had never been admitted. What was also interesting about that select committee was that they said that in other jurisdictions where they do allow assisted dying, there had been no slippage. In other words, they started with one law and they slipped into another law. And we talked about Belgium earlier. They started with a much broader category, which does allow people who are not terminally ill. We don't want that. I don't want that. And I can guarantee you that it would not pass the MPs if that was proposed. We want strictly limited to terminally ill.
Where are you at the moment with your campaign?
Well, it's now very much on the political agenda, and it's getting closer to England all the time, literally, because there's a bill going through in Jersey, there's another bill going through in the Isle of Man, it's being debated in France, it's being debated in Ireland, and of course there's also a bill now in Holyrood, just north of the border. Everyone is discussing it. When England discusses it, we will not be venturing into the dark, we will be the last ones to go along with it. And hopefully, the example of all these other countries, where it is going to be on offer as an option, and that's a crucial thing, it is an option. It just means that we have a almost menu of ways in which to end our days, at home, in hospital, in hospice, assisted dying. And just to clear up one thing, people often think that it means somebody else kills you. They don't. Assisted is only in the sense that you get the prescription from a doctor, which you can then take to a chemist, and it's absolutely essential that you yourself, the patient, actually takes the prescription and takes the life-ending medication. The assistance is only in the paperwork to obtain it, and that's also very important to ensure that the person actually does want to do it, not that it's done to them by somebody else.
And are we talking about something you drink or
an injection? Yes.
So the same as if you went to Dignitas.
Yes.
You take it at a moment of your own.
Yes, it's a potion and you can, that's right, and you can get it from the chemist and then you can decide not to use it or you can wait a couple of weeks or you can do it at home or you can do it in a park bench or you can do it with the dog on your lap or you can do it in hospice, wherever. Under the current proposals, doctors will not be obliged to prescribe. So a bit, if they have a conscientious objection, a bit like with abortion, they don't have to help, but they do are obliged to direct them to another doctor who could do so. Plus, in a sense, actually, a lot of doctors will be relieved of pressure to a certain extent because, as I'm sure everyone listening to this podcast will know, you go to a hospital or hospice, see someone dying, and they are begging the doctors, please, doctor, can you do something for me? They're saying to the nurses, why can't you help me? And of course they can't, doctors and nurses, because it's illegal. But they may well be sympathetic to it.
Have you had a lot of conversations with GPs and doctors about this?
Everybody, whether it's clerics or MPs or GPs or members of the public. It's really interesting to note that the British Medical Association, you know, the representative body of all GPs, has actually changed its stance on assisted dying. And it used to be against, and a couple of years ago, it switched position and it's now neutral. Not just the BMA, but also most of the Royal Colleges, Royal College of Nursing, Royal College of Physicians, of Surgeons, of Psychologists, they've all shifted to neutral. And I think that says something about the medical profession when it also changes its mind. I mean, it's a very much a talked about issue, and rightly so, and very timely. I mean, we've been pretty bad about talking about death anyway. I mean, I often think we're the exact opposite of the Victorians, who did death very well and talked about it constantly and painted it, but sex was a taboo subject. We have sex all over the place, but don't do death at all. We're rather scared of it.
So people have been happy to engage with you. People in the medical profession to be happy to engage.
Yes, and whether they are just inquiring about what does it involve, or they're passionately in favour, or they're vehemently against. But even those who are against, I had an interesting experience not so long ago where I talked to a group of people who were very much against it. And I got battered with questions, pretty hostile questions, fair enough, no problem. And at the end of it, and there were about 100 people in the room, at the end of it I said, look, I know you've got these reservations, philosophical, practical reservations, but let me just ask you one question before we end, which is, if you yourself were dying in pain and in really great distress, would you like the option of an assisted death for yourself? And I tell you, of those 100 people, 100 hands shot up. And I said, right, if you want it for yourself, why are you denying it to other people?
That is bizarre.
Bizarre, but it just reflects that although people might have intellectual reservations, actually, when it comes down to it, they want it for themselves.
So did you get the feeling they would vote in favour after?
Not necessarily, because some people have a sort of ideology they just can't get around or they won't let go. But this is not about ideology for me. It's about people and individuals and helping people. Like the person I saw about 3 or 4 weeks ago, again in the hospice, who said to me, every night when I go to bed, I pray to God that I won't wake up. And every morning I'm disappointed. It's that sort of person who we want to help and give her the option that she can choose. Not me, not you, not the doctors, that she can have that right of choice. And I honestly don't think we have the right to deny her that choice.
But playing devil's advocate, there will be people who would say her life wasn't ready to end.
Well, whose choice is that? Whose call is that? Whose decision is that? Has to be hers, doesn't it?
I suppose what I'm saying is that there are some people who think we have a natural lifespan and that it'll end at its right time. And if you ease it forward, that's not right.
Yeah, and they will push it further and say that you're playing God, or you're intervening, which is, if you think about it, a nonsense argument. We are constantly thwarting the will of God. If we see someone collapse in the street and frothing at the mouth, and we don't step over them and say, oh, well, that's God's will. We intervene, we get out a defibrillator, we call the ambulance, we give them a heart transplant or a blood transfusion. We're constantly playing God. And if we can play God to save life, great. Can we not also play God to save pain? And it's not about shortening life. It's about shortening death.
How does this fit in with your faith?
Very well. I mean, I am coming from a religious perspective, specifically Jewish, but it's a perspective that will be certainly shared by many religious Christians. In fact, I started off by becoming chair of what we call the Religious Alliance for Assisted Dying, because there was a sort of an impression that if you were religious, you were against it. And it's certainly true that the religious hierarchy are against it. Archbishop of Canterbury, Cardinal, Catholic Cardinal of Westminster, Chief Rabbi, they're all against it. But if you talk to a lot of clergy, yes, some are against, but some are very much in favour. It's just those voices haven't been heard, and I was trying to give expression to that. And certainly many people in the pews. When I go to churches or synagogues and speak about it, I always expect to be sort of like Daniel in the lion's den. Actually, the opposite. I'm constantly pushing at an open door. And everything I said was, yes, a humanist might say, but for me, it comes from a religious perspective about compassion. And it's as simple as that. And yes, I have a clear idea about how it is to live a good life and a not so good life. But to me, pain is not godly. It's to be avoided. People are there not to suffer, but to be helped. And if this is a way of helping those who so wish, again, I emphasise, who so wish, and who are terminally ill, then why not? And, I mean, obviously most people are Christian, as is the country. So, and the former Archbishop, Lord Carey, George Carey, is someone who came out, so to speak, and is now very much in favour, as did Desmond Tutu before his death. And, you know, you can't get much more iconic religious figure than Desmond Tutu. And people often don't realise that there's actually a lot of people who are very religious and very much in favour.
Jonathan, thank you so much for talking to me.
I'm happy to be joined today by Ros Doherty, who we've spoken to before, and she was full of useful advice in the last episode. This time, we're going to talk to her about assisted dying and find out what her views are about this.
Thank you very much for having me back and giving me the opportunity to share my thoughts on this. I think the first thing I would say is that the whole subject of assisted dying or assisted suicide, as some people call it, is an extremely complex situation. And I have the greatest compassion for anybody who is in a situation, either personally or as a family member, where an individual feels that they have to make some of these choices. And I can only give you what I see are my own views on the subject. And I'm very conscious that my views are conditioned and informed by my personal experience, including my upbringing as a Catholic, and also my experience of death in my family, and also that I have studied end-of-life situations as part of my studies at various stages. It is a personal view, and I would be very careful of saying that it is only my experience, and I think other people will arrive at different outcomes. I suppose my key argument is that I truly believe that if we had better palliative and end-of-life care facilities available for a number of people, they wouldn't feel the need to consider assisted dying. And I think my approach is that I am neutral in relation to any legislation, but from a personal point of view, I would be very uncomfortable if I felt the need to consider assisted dying personally. I have a lot of experience from family members of good hospice care and good palliative care. And my first husband died in a hospice, and he was only there for 4 days, but the care and the love and the support that he got in that environment was just phenomenal. And while he was very ill for the last 2 days of that period, the first couple of days, he was able to enjoy some time with his family and his grandchildren. And he was able to talk to us as a family about what he wanted and his wishes for the family for the future. And he died because his body had packed up. He had cancer, and it was the end of the road. His organs were failing and his body had packed up. But until the last 36 hours, he was truly himself, truly in control of his life. It seems a strange thing to say, but as much as any of us are. And the environment was just so supportive and nurturing that we all felt able to say goodbye to him, and we all felt able to leave him comfortable in the fact that he was being well cared for at all times. The alternative of having to involve either a medical professional or a family member, the administration of medication, which, as I understand it, isn't always very pleasant to take, and the sudden death as a consequence of that, seems to me less supportive and less attractive for the family than the care that he got in the hospice.
But you have said up until 36 hours before he died, did things go wrong after that, or was he not so comfortable after that?
He was on pump syringe. His swallow reflex went, so he wasn't able to take his medication through oral means. And he wasn't able to take pain relief through oral means. So he was on a pump syringe, which meant that the medication was administered by the staff as a response to how his body was reacting. And if he appeared to be in any sense of distress, they were able to up the medicine necessarily. So that last 36 hours, he was asleep for most of the time, not all the time. It was like being very drowsy, and when he was awake, he was very weak. He didn't eat or he didn't drink, but he was able to communicate with us for the first part of that 36 hours. But latterly, he just slept and just slept more and more and more. And then his bodily functions slowed down, his breathing became less frequent, until he finally died.
So that's an experience of a very good death in a hospice, yes, without pain. And he was obviously content.
Without pain, and I think for me, probably equally important, was with dignity. He was dignified. There was nothing that happened to him that was embarrassing or unpleasant or not prepared for. He and we were prepared for what was going to happen next. And he knew what was going to happen. He knew he was going to fall asleep. He knew that he wasn't going to be able to eat anymore, and that the periods of sleepiness would get longer and longer and longer, and then that would be until such time as he stopped breathing. So it was a maintenance of dignity, a maintenance of care, and in a nursing environment where the nurses who looked after him were nurturing and caring and supportive throughout.
But what would you say to people who argue that some deaths involve a great degree of pain?
I think that's true. And I think even palliative care specialists will say that there are some instances where it is not possible to remove pain completely. And I know of people who said that they were not, that their family members were not able to have the pain regulated and controlled. But I do understand that must be a very distressing and difficult situation for the families. But my experience of, or my awareness of how assisted suicide works, is that they're not necessarily the situations where people are in a position to make their minds up about what happens. I did quite a bit of work on it when I was at Yale, that we did a lot on end-of-life care. And one of the models we looked at was the Oregon model, which is one of the first ones in the States. And I think it's the base on which most of the states that are involved in end-of-life, assisted suicide in America, use as their model, because I think it was the first one. And here, the medication is given out to the patients and they take it themselves. And people are offered that medication quite a long time before they are near that point of death. We saw videos, we had lecture from one of the women who actually goes out and distributes the medication to people. Now, not everybody takes it, but that medication is made available to people much sooner than they would naturally die. And I think this is one of my concerns about any effective system of assisted dying, is that people may well die at a time prior to when they would naturally die. And my argument is that in some instances, they are missing quality time with their families at that particular end of life, where it is so important to cherish and value all the time that you do have with your families. So I understand how hard it can be for some people, but from what I've seen of the models of assisted dying or assisted suicide available, I'm not comfortable that any of them are actually administered in such a way that it is just because people are in pain.
Well, I was just going on to say, what about other things which don't involve pain? But say you've got some form of throat cancer and you fear not being able to swallow or not being able to take your last breath, or being breathless and not being able to catch your breath. I mean, that's frightening.
It is frightening, but I do believe that good palliative care in a hospice environment, or even in people's own home, you're able to provide hospice at home for a lot of people now, does mean that people can have relaxants, they can have antidepressants, they can have anti-anxiety medication, so that they don't have to have that distressing experience. It does happen. I can't say it doesn't happen, but I think it happens less. And I think very often it's the fear of those experiences that prompts people to make the decision to go for assisted dying or assisted suicide. And they don't have to have that experience. In most instances, there is medication that can help and support them through that.
I'm sure you're right about the fear, because that's the problem, isn't it? None of us know what to expect. We don't talk about it enough. We don't know how our own death will happen. And as I've said before, I think the baby boomer generation is so used to getting its own way that we've got to the stage where a lot of us think, well, I've ordered everything else for myself. Why can't I do this myself too?
There is also concern about how the initial legislation in those places where it has been enacted has been expanded and moved beyond what was originally envisaged. And I'm very aware that the slippery slope argument is not a philosophical argument, and it is not a reason not to take what is the right action. But nevertheless, it is a practical argument. And the option of assisted suicide, assisted dying, can have the impact that people who are not necessarily terminally ill may feel pressurized to go for that option when they could have good quality of life right up till the time of a natural death. And that can be two types of pressure. It can be internal pressure. I think all us who are older desperately don't want to be a burden on our family. And I can understand the argument where if I took a tablet now, then I wouldn't be a problem to anybody going forward. And also external pressure. There is some evidence that some elderly people feel pressurized by their families, because being old, being infirm, needing help and support is an added burden to your family. And in some instances, there is some evidence that it does have impact on decisions that people make. I also think that the legislation, where it is available for, what do they call it, unbearable suffering, can be so easily expanded to include anything. And, you know, there are examples in Canada and in some of the European countries where it's been enacted, where people who have mental health problems are wanting to avail of assisted suicide. I read recently of a woman of 36 who's got anorexia who wanted to avail of assisted suicide. We've all had times in our lives when life has been very tough, and when we have felt, I'm sure, I can't go on. I certainly have, and I suspect most people at some stage, or that it is so unbearable, it's not worth getting up, or it's not worth getting out of bed. Now, most of those situations don't continue. It might be momentarily, it might be for a day, it might be for a week, it might be for longer. My mother was in bereavement grief for something like 10 years. But she then did get recovery from that. And the last years of her life were very rich and fulfilling and rewarding. And I think there's a danger if assisted suicide and assisted dying was too easily available, and it becomes increasingly available as the timescales move on, then the chances are people will make those decisions in moment of great distress, when really what they need might be more support, might be more therapy, might be more medical intervention. And in some instances, people can move on and have a better life subsequently. I found the Oregon model extremely distressing, I have to say. We had one of the women who was involved in the model working there, coming along and talking to us. And she just seemed to me like an angel of death. She was turning up at people's houses with this medication. Now, most of them would have had a consultation previously, and the medication was left there. There was no supervision. The plan was that people would take it themselves when they felt they'd had enough. I'm not sure whether, I think it probably was just terminal diagnosis in Oregon, but not everybody takes it. I think there's something like only 55% of the people who have the medication made available actually take it. But the whole thing felt to me, from what I saw, both in terms of her lecture and the video she showed us, as if it was, yes, you're dying, let's speed it up a little bit, and I'll leave the medication here. They did have it explained to them. I'm simplifying it a little bit. But it just did seem to me that it was offered as an alternative to palliative care, and it was offered as an alternative to hospice, either in a home or in a hospice, because it was seen as another option. Where my argument is, if there was good palliative care available and good hospice care available, then less people would want that as an alternative. And I didn't feel comfortable with it at all. In fact, one of the lecturers she gave, I had to leave because I found that it distressed me emotionally. And I am conscious that there is sometimes a conflict between head and heart in terms of these things. Logically, you can have an argument about autonomy and the individual's right to choose and making informed consent. And from a rational point of view, I can totally accept that that is absolutely right. And I want autonomy and I want informed consent. But there is also the emotional connection about, you're talking about the ending of a person's life here, and that life is valuable and that life is sacred and it is important right until such time as that person dies, whenever that might be. And the message that came from the Oregon model that I looked at was that autonomy trumps everything. Autonomy and informed consent trump everything, but they don't, it doesn't. And there are other considerations. And I have not seen a model yet put forward that I think reflects the value and the importance of the human life.
Now, you started off by saying, and you've just said it again just now, that you don't think it would be necessary for us even to be talking about assisted dying if palliative care and hospice care were more widely available. They're not, are they? Not enough.
No, they're not. They're not. So my argument would be, rather than focusing on developing assisted dying systems, that we focus much more on expanding palliative care. And yes, it costs money, and yes, it takes time and it takes energy, but good palliative care means that the quality of people's lives is good right until the end. And if that was the case, why would people then want to go for a proactive assisted dying?
Ros Doherty, thank you so much for sharing your views.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.